Welcome to Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. Today, our guest is Brandy Stitt from the Women's Business Center. Good morning, Brandy, and welcome to Cowtown Conversations.
Good morning, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. So I have been in the small business and entrepreneurial community for about 15 years in the Kansas City market. I started out with the Greater Kansas City Chamber, running their small business programs, and then was there for about 10 years and left for a short stint at KC Source Link, which works with small businesses, connecting them to resources in the community. And I left there about 4 years ago to serve as the program director for the Women's Business Center here in Kansas City.
What is the mission of the Women's Business Center?
The Women's Business Center's role is really to help women, primarily, as that's our focus market, to start, grow, and fund their businesses. We serve the Kansas City Metro, both sides of the state line, as well as the entire state of Kansas, remotely, obviously, on the western side of Kansas, since we are headquartered and based physically in the Kansas City Metro.
Where are you located? Where are your offices physically located?
Our offices are in Fairway, Kansas. We are just off Shawnee Mission Parkway next to Stroud's. Everyone can find us if they know where Stroud's is at. But we're in the office buildings there. Our host organization is the Enterprise Center of Johnson County, which is a co-working space that we have. Some of our clients can access and use that space as well.
I know it's called the Women's Business Center, the WBC, but are your programs open to both women and men? I know I've attended a few events at your organization.
Yes, our programs, for the most part, are open to men and women. All of our workshops and all of our counseling services are open to the public. We do have a couple of our funding programs that are designated for women-led businesses. There can be a male on the leadership team, but we have to have a female on that leadership team as well to be able to fund those particular businesses.
Are the programs and resources that you offer for those that are already established in businesses, or do you have programs that for those that may be thinking about starting a business or just may have a business idea or concept?
We serve the full continuum of business. So we have a significant number of our clients, I would say around 60%, that are in the concept stage, that have an idea. They don't know if it's a good idea, and they're really trying to evaluate the feasibility and whether they can afford to start that business right now. So that does consist of a large portion of our client base. We do also have services for those businesses that are already in existence but are looking for either guidance or funding to help them really grow to that next level.
What is the first thing a potential business owner needs to think about before starting a business?
We have a couple different ways that we look at an early stage business. So the first thing really is there a need for your product or service in the market, and will people pay for it? So what we find is that a lot of people ask their friends, they ask their family, hey, I have this idea, what do you think? Is it a good idea? And of course they're going to say yes because they love and support that person. But the reality is it could be a good idea, but it could be something that maybe already exists in the market. It could be something that people are already getting for free and they wouldn't necessarily pay for that. So we're really wanting them to evaluate, is this something that people need, that they want, and will they pay for it?
Evaluation means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. What is the part of that evaluation process of the business idea concept?
We're really going to sit down and talk with our clients one-on-one to help them vet the marketplace. Each community is going to be a little bit different. We want to hear what they think is unique about their product or service, if there are other similar products and services in the market. We want to know if they've already determined, who is your customer base, Does that customer base exist in the Kansas City market, or is this going to be more of a national product? So we really want to sit down and have that conversation with them. It's less about going through a checklist. It's more about the conversation with the client about, you know, what research have you done? What research needs to be done? Have you put together any type of cash flow analysis to look at, you know, the profitability of this particular product or service? So it's really conversational to start.
How important is it to look at to see who your competition will be? Because everybody, I lived in small town America for a few years when I was in the military, and they call Walmart the small town killer, because mm-hmm. when Walmart comes into a community, they can look and see, well, this business is not going to be in town for maybe in business for about 4 or 5 months. How important is it to look at competition, who your competition is going to be when you're looking to open up a small business?
It's definitely an important piece of that feasibility analysis. You want to look at, you know, who is already in the market doing what you want to do. How are you going to be different? Is it that your service that you're providing to the customer is more excellent than the competitors in your marketplace? Maybe it's that you're just differentiating your marketing strategy in a new way. So you do want to look at who your direct competitors are, who's doing exactly what you're doing, and then who are your indirect competitors. So maybe you want to open up a food truck. You know, your indirect competitors are going to be not necessarily other food trucks, is going to be anyone else that sells food within the area that you want to serve. It could be Quick Trip. It could be a McDonald's. It could be a sit-down restaurant. So who are your indirect competitors that are providing similar services but are not doing exactly what you're doing?
When you think about a business today, how important is it to also think about online competition? Because I know a lot of people look at, well, brick and mortar is a lot more expensive, and you can buy something online a lot cheaper because you don't have mm-hmm. to worry about having that brick and mortar store. So online is a lot cheaper. You know, you can go to Walmart and buy something in the store for one price, but you go to Walmart.com and it's a lot cheaper there. So how important is that for people to think about when they're looking at a potential business?
I think online businesses are really an important component, and starting your presence online, if you are going to be specifically a retail-based business, we always suggest testing the waters with an online business first, because the expense is so much lower than opening a brick-and-mortar store. It can be more difficult to get your message out, but using social media to promote your business online is a really cost-effective way, maybe not as time-effective, but it's certainly cost-effective when you're looking at, you know, you're not having to purchase advertising, you're not having to have a storefront and have signage and really drive traffic to a location that's physical-based that has all that expense. You know, we like to recommend, especially for our retail clients, let's test the waters with an online business. Maybe it's even if it's a craft type business, maybe we're looking at an Etsy model, or you're selling through different Facebook platforms. So really evaluating what makes sense to initially get started based on the expense and the amount really of revenue that you have to get the business going with.
You offer some excellent programs at the WBC, such as the Fast Track New Venture, the Growth Mentoring Service, the Peer-to-Peer Roundtable. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about these mentoring programs and some of the other programs that you offer at the WBC?
Absolutely. So we, the New Venture Program, and we have another program that's called Launch You. These are really for those individuals that are either at the concept stage or that have been in business for a little while, let's say 6 to 12 months, but they never really developed a marketing plan or they never really put together financial projections, and they kind of need to slow down and go back and have a plan in place for your business. So those are multi-week business development classes. They're really going to help you build out that competitive analysis, market analysis, financial projections, which are critically important for all stages of business. So those are our multi-week business planning classes. We also have growth mentoring services, which is a team mentoring approach. So it connects 3 to 4 mentors that are seasoned professionals and brings them to an entrepreneur that's still in the earlier stages of their business to really help them develop strategy for that business. So these are companies, entrepreneurs that, you know, they've got $100,000 in revenue. They really have a plan to grow. They have in mind that they want to get to that $1 million business level, but they need some strategic advisors that can direct them. And that's really also what the roundtables are designed to do. They're established businesses that are really looking for that peer-to-peer feedback. I'm a woman business owner. I have this challenge with my business. You've already been through something like that. How did that work for you? What were your solutions? How did you make it so that it wasn't a pain point for you anymore?
How important is it when you're just starting out in business to have a mentor, to have somebody to be able to sit down when you've had that rough day, and just when you didn't think it could get any worse, and you find out that the truck didn't show up on time, or this delivery is going to be late, are you having to find a way to reinvent the wheel or do something else different because you've got a different problem on top of the other 1,000 problems that you already have? How can that mentor be of great assistance to you during those hard times?
It's tremendously important. Entrepreneurship is often described as the loneliest business that you can be in because you're, as the business owner, it often feels like you're the only one on this little island for the business trying to make these decisions, and it can be very lonely. Mentors can help to provide that support that the entrepreneur needs. Many times they feel like they can't go to their employees to get guidance and feedback. They need other peers or people that have been in business longer than them that can just give them, hey, you know, yeah, I've had that happen too. Here's what I did. Or have you thought about doing something like this? Mentorship can be that support system and can provide the advice that the entrepreneur needs. Kansas City is a very supportive entrepreneurial environment. We talk to a lot of business owners and entrepreneurs that say there are no formal mentorship programs for business at my stage of business. And mentorship doesn't have to be a formal relationship. It can be an informal relationship. It can be that business owner that you admire that you reach out to and say, hey, you know, I really admire what you've done with your business. I'm starting this new business that's could really use some guidance in an area that I think you have expertise. Would you meet me for coffee? And 9 times out of 10, they're going to say yes. So it's reaching out to those informal mentors that maybe you're not going to meet with them for 12 months. Maybe you just have coffee once or twice, but it's people that you could reach out to. There are also a lot of nonprofit organizations that can provide those types of supports. Our counselors are there at a phone call's notice. The SCORE mentors are there to provide that ongoing mentorship. And those are services that are at no cost to the small businesses in our community. So, what I say is reach out, ask for help. If you think you need it, if you're stuck, ask for help.
How does the WBC help those who are interested in starting a business in, say, Missouri and Kansas navigate the potential red tape in some cases, maybe getting that LLC, finding out, you know, what you need to do to get the IRS, the employee identification number, those two particular type of things?
We, are familiar with those processes. They can certainly be very challenging and confusing when you're not sure, do I need an LLC? Should I be an LLC with an S-Corp? We can help navigate some of that and make those referrals, connect you directly to the link on the websites that you need to go to get registered, or direct you to KC BizCare downtown to get your registrations and licenses. So we'll make those referrals for you and help you to navigate some of that. And if we don't know the answer, we can connect you to the resource that does have an answer for you. There are a lot of people in the community that can help, and we can help navigate. And we have our checklist of, do you have this? Do you have that? If you're this type of business, you need to make sure that you are paying sales tax and you're charging sales tax, and here's how frequently you're going to need to pay that sales tax. So we can help navigate some of those really confusing pieces on just the business organizational side. Business owners are very often very good technicians in whatever it is that they're doing, but they don't always know the business side of operating that business.
The one thing that a lot of business owners may not look at, many businesses fail in the first 3 years due to lack of capital. Does the Women's Business Center help those assist with finding financing or microloans for business office for business owners?
We do. We believe, as most other organizations, I think that it comes down to the numbers. At the end of the day, it comes down to the numbers. So the first thing we're going to do before we even recommend a source of capital is really analyze the financial projections, and if there are existing financial statements, which we hope that there are if you're in business, we're going to look at those and see what are the key performance indicators, where are the areas where we think the percentage of spend is off. Maybe we need to adjust some of your expenses. What can we do to make the business a little bit more profitable? Maybe we need to find a way to increase sales. So we're going to look at your current financial position first before we recommend any outside capital, because we want to make sure that we don't overcapitalize you if you are in a position that you don't need to take on any debt. But we will, if we see that, you know what, let's look at a microloan or another debt-type product that can help you to really accelerate the growth of your business. A lot of times it's just, I need this piece of equipment. I need it now. I can't grow without it. So we're going to look at what type of loan product is going to make the most sense. Microloans are great for individuals that don't need a lot of money, but they're not in a position to get a bank loan. So these are people that maybe their credit score is generally below a 680. Maybe it's that they don't have the type of collateral match that a bank wants to see. Maybe it's that they're a startup and banks tend to be fairly averse to lending to startups. So microloans are really good products for that individual that, I just need $10,000, but I can't get a bank loan. Those are really great products for those types of individuals. If they're in a position that they could secure a bank loan, we're going to talk about things like home equity loans or lines of credit or SBA guarantee loans, depending on how much they're looking for funding. And we're going to guide them in that process. Here's what a bank is going to ask you. Here's what you need to have ready. Let's get that business plan polished. Let's make sure you've got three years worth of financial statements and projections that bank is going to want to have. So we could help with a lot of the packaging work that goes into preparing for a loan product.
So when you say microloan, what exactly, you kind of defined it a little bit, but it's a little bit of a different name. So exactly what is a microloan compared to a bank loan?
A microloan is going to be a small loan. Typically, they range from $500 to $50,000, and these are riskier loans. So again, these are loans that a bank isn't going to be able to close. They are really intended for any purpose within the business. They can be used for working capital. They can be used to purchase equipment. They can be used to purchase inventory. They can be used to hire employees. They can be used for a variety of purposes, but they're traditionally going to be provided to the entrepreneur or the business owner through a nonprofit entity. And these are organizations that are like the Women's Business Center. We have a microloan. We're a nonprofit. We have a loan pool that we raise through grants and other fundraising mechanisms to be able to loan out money to our client base. And that is very similar. We're one of four microlenders in the community. And we're fairly small. There are other microlenders that in Kansas City that are a little bit larger. We're very intentional with our clients. We want to make sure that they're getting the right technical assistance in addition to the loan. We never want to give a client a loan and say good luck. We want to make sure that we're there supporting them along the way and figuring out you know, you wanted the loan for this purpose, but I think it might make more sense if we look at some of these other ideas as well for helping you to deploy those loans.
What is the best thing that a client needs to do in order to get prepared when they see that, okay, cash flow is not where it needs mm-hmm. to be at that point in time, because cash is king when you're running a business? What do you need to start looking at doing when you see the cash is not where you're going to need it to be and you're going to have a short period? What do you need to do at that point in time to start getting ready to overcome those periods where cash, you're going to have a cash shortage?
Sure. I think the first thing you want to look at is, why is there a cash shortage? So is it that it's a seasonal business and you're always going to have less revenue coming into the business during a certain time frame? Is it that there's an less need or less demand for your product or service? Maybe there's a new competitor in the market that is taking business away from you. So is it a drop in sales? Have you had an increase in your expenses? The first thing is really to figure out, why is the cash flow going to be lower over a certain amount of time? Our hope is that you're watching your financials regularly and you can anticipate some of those cash flow shortages. That's where things like lines of credit are really beneficial, because you don't use the money unless you need it. And, you know, banks don't want to give you money when you need it. They want to give you money when you don't need it. So you want to be able to try to anticipate some of that. But the reality is, most of our clients don't realize there's a cash flow shortage until they're already 2 to 3 months into that cash flow shortage. So then we're going to work on, okay, what are some short-term strategies here? Is there a short-term way for us to decrease your expenses? Or can we look at something like a micro loan that's just going to be a short-term fix for you? Or maybe it's, depending on your business, maybe you need a contractor loan that's a short-term loan that's going to help you fulfill that specific contract make sure that your employees are paid or you have the inventory that you need to fulfill that. So we're going to look at some short-term strategies to help bridge that cash flow. But at the end of the day, it's always going to come back to that long-term. Okay, let's get you through the short-term problem, but long term, what are we going to do to manage and mitigate these cash flow deficiencies in the future?
A lot of people don't understand Black Friday is called Black Friday for a reason, because it's that one Friday right after Thanksgiving where many retailers go from being in the red all year long to that one Friday puts them into the black. Mm-hmm. So all because of cash flow, and it's a lot of loans, a lot of credit that they use. And you wouldn't think Toys R Us filed bankruptcy because cash flow problems. It's not that they don't sell a lot of toys, but the majority of the toys are sold around Christmas time. So if Toys R Us can file bankruptcy, the normal small mom and pop business can file bankruptcy, because there's a lot of competition from Walmart, Walmart.com now, Amazon. So there's a lot of things you really look at. How important is it for the entrepreneur or potential business owner to have a good personal credit history when they're thinking about starting a business or opening a business?
Credit, personal credit, is really the most important credit for really businesses under 10 years. Any loan that you're going to get, even a bank loan, they'll look at business credit, but at the end of the day, it's the personal credit of the person that owns that business. We like to say the person that pays the electric bill at home is the same person that pays the electric bill for the business. And if they're not paying it at home, they're probably not paying it for the business either. So your personal credit is really your word. It's your guarantee to that lender. So you want to look at making sure you're paying your bills on time. You know, the simple things. Pay your bills on time. Make sure you always have 3 active lines of credit at any given time. And that should be a mix of installment and revolving credit. So installment credit is going to be things like student loans, car payments, mortgages. It's the same payment amount each month. Revolving would be credit cards. So it could be a different amount each month, depending on how much you spent on your credit card that month. much on that month. So you want to make sure you have a mix of those. You want to keep your credit card debt under 30% of what your maximum allowable credit is. So if your credit card is a $10,000 max, let's not spend more than $3,000 on that credit card. You know, FICO takes a look at that, and they're using that as a weighting system to look at, you know, your credit risk. Do you need more money than you have? That's what they're looking for, is they're evaluating those credit cards. So making sure your credit is healthy is going to be important, because when you're looking at securing significant amounts of capital or even applying for a business credit card, the banks are looking at what is your credit score, what's your credit history. You want to make sure that you have a credit score at least around 680 or higher. Some banks really want you to be at a 720 and higher before they'll even consider a loan. So keep those in mind and monitor your credit. Use the free resources that are available to check your credit reports annually so that you can see if there's any fraud or anything that's incorrect that you need to dispute that's on your credit.
I know another good resource is Credit Karma. It allows people to take a look at their credit score. It may not be as accurate, but it gives you a good idea what your credit score would be so that you, before you go to that bank and apply for a loan,
right,
that you can have a good idea. So if they ask you, you know, what's your credit score, then you kind of know what it is without, I think it's good. And then that's
right.
when you're at your banker, that's not the time to kind of figure out.
That's not the time. And you can also pull your credit report. You won't get a score, but you can pull the report for free through
annualcreditreport.com,
and you can pull from all three credit bureaus once a year. Yeah. So that's something I always recommend as well, so that you can see what is showing up on your credit report.
And if you, a tip to that is if you pull, say, one in January, you go back in April, you pull another one.
Right.
And
yeah,
then you pull the next one again in, say, 4 months later, you can continuously keep pulling it. So as you begin to pay things off, you can see the improvement in your credit history, but also gives you time to be able to see, because if you dispute something on one, it'll come off of the other, so you'll be able to see it without you having to take that hit on your credit. So as we begin to wind down, does the WBC have a website where our listeners can go if they would like to learn more about your organization and the type of programs and services that you have available?
Yes, our website is KansasCityWBC.com, and we have all of our programs and services listed on that site, and you can also access our 1KC for Women Resource Partners websites through that site as well.
What is the phone number for the WBC if they would like to call the Women's Business Center and schedule an appointment?
Our phone number is 913-492-5922.
And what are the hours of operation each day?
We are open Monday through Friday from 8 to 5. We also will schedule evening and weekend appointments as requested or needed by clients if they are working full-time and simply just cannot leave the workspace to be able to meet during those office hours.
Thank you so much, Brandy, for being our guest today on Cowtown Conversations. And congratulations on the great work you're doing at the Women's Business Center for helping women to get into business.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed being on the program.
We never end Cowtown Conversations without our Community Minute. Emmanuel's Family and Child Development Center will host their Miracle on 35th Street event December 25th from 1 to 3 p.m. at Emmanuel's Community Center, 3510 Prospect Avenue. The event finishes a free Christmas lunch with food, entertainment, and gifts for the community. Transportation is available if needed. For more information, please call 816-921-3164. So for Cowtown Conversations, this is your host, Joseph Jackson. Tune in next week when we'll have representatives from the police department, and we'll be talking about 21st century police techniques and how community surveillance cameras are helping catch criminals. So tune in next week.
Before you click on on Amazon.com to find the perfect gifts this holiday season. Tune into the Heartland Labor Forum to find out how poor working conditions, unfair competition, and billions in tax incentives have made Amazon the Walmart of the Internet. We'll first talk with Jobs with Justice about their wish list for Amazon's new headquarters and how the company treats its employees. Then, we'll ask the Institute for Local Self-Reliance about Amazon's appetite for your tax dollars. Tune in Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
Did you know you can support any or all shows on KKFI by becoming an underwriter? Underwriting identifies your business, products, and services as supporting community radio programs, putting your enterprise in touch with the community. To learn more about supporting KKFI and spreading the word that you do, go to kkfi.org/underwriting.
This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. Whether it's the search for inner peace or learning how to resolve conflicts we have with others in our families, workplaces, communities, or between nations, we consider it here on Peace Talks Radio. We also look at great peacemakers and peace moments from throughout history and today. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, and today we spotlight two instances when peace broke out right on the field of battle. Later, we'll hear a report on a peace jubilee at the Manassas battlefield, scene of brutal engagements during the U.S. Civil War. One peace jubilee that took place in 1911 was commemorated on its 100th anniversary in 2011. But first, the impromptu but widespread unofficial Christmas truce of 1914, in the early months of fighting in Europe in World War I, when soldiers from both sides essentially said, "War is hell, let's not do it near Christmas Day." To tell us that story, we have Stanley Weintraub, historian, professor emeritus from Penn State University, biographer, and author of many books, including Silent Night, The Christmas Truce of 1914. He joins us from his home in Delaware. Dr. Weintraub, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
I know it's kind of basic history, but let's remind listeners of the where and the who of this event. Now, approaching Christmas time, 1914, describe the place and the principals assembled there.
There was war going on between Germany and Belgium, France, and England that was largely focused upon the area in Flanders, which is lowland close to the English Channel in the North Sea. Yet the fighting went on south all the way to Switzerland, several hundred miles of trench warfare at that point.
And opposing sides were often just yards apart, isn't that right?
They were often only yards apart, perhaps 75 yards apart, which isn't much when you think in terms of a football field being 100 yards. Therefore, they were very close. They were also very uncomfortable. The trenches filled with water. They put down wooden planks when they could. There were rats infesting the trenches. The rats fed on the dead. The dead were in what we called no man's land between the two sides. So the area between the two sides was close. It was also a terrible, smelly, awful mess.
It sounds like there was some fraternization from afar, in a way, between the sides in the weeks before Christmas.
Because they were so close, as we've been talking about, they could shout to each other. They could call each other names. They even got to know the first names of troops across the way. Many of the Germans had actually worked in England. They worked as barbers. They worked as wagon drivers and so on. And they knew English. And they were called back to Germany when the war began. Even if the English didn't know much German, the Germans knew a great deal of English.
About a week ahead of Christmas proper, according to these stories, there was a brief cooperative truce around a German trench concert. Can you tell that story?
The Germans, they wanted to have a concert, and they said, if you stop firing, you'll be able to listen to our concert. And the troops nearby, and of course this was one small sector, actually did so. But during the truce itself, it became such a spontaneous and widespread event that the Germans sent one member of the general staff, who was a singer in the Berlin Opera, out to sing Silent Night, across the trenches. And the French, who claimed that they hated the Germans and wouldn't have any ceasefire of any sort, sent a tenor from the Paris Opera, and he sang O Holy Night, Cantique de Noël, across the trenches. So the idea of we can do better than you can do with Christmas songs continued that business of music across the enemy lines.
Here's how that more friendly musical competition was portrayed in the film Joyeux Noël from 2005. In this adaptation, a Scottish bagpipe answers the German tenor.
When the Germans began to actually light the candles on their little trees, the British wondered what it was, what was going on. And at a distance of 75 or 100 yards, they weren't sure. And some of them crept closer through the mud to see what was going on, and discovered that the Germans were lighting their Christmas trees. The Germans, realizing that there were troops approaching them, crawled out too, and the troops met each other. This happened in many places along the front lines, especially in Flanders. The British did not have trees, but they had something else that they could show the Germans. I'm holding in my hand a brass box that says Christmas 1914, and it has the head of embossed head of Princess Mary, one of the daughter of King George V. The British actually sent over to the front lines hundreds of thousands of these brass boxes. Some of them were filled with candy. Some of them had tobacco. And there was a campaign to get these to the troops. When the Germans discovered that the British were doing this, they quickly began to fabricate wooden boxes with sausages and cigars and so on. And both sides, it seemed, as they crawled out to meet each other, had things to trade. And so there was a swapping of Christmas gifts. And this was not expected. No one thought that when you sent something for your own troops' morale, they would use it to swap. But these little boxes did do this. And when they got together in no man's land on Christmas Eve, they were not only in mucky territory, but there were shell holes and there were bodies. And they began to think in terms of burying the dead. That if they buried the dead, they might be able to get together the next day and not only do that, but perhaps trade gifts, and some of them said, and play football, football meaning our soccer. And they did. And this was one of the things that, when I was working on the earlier book on the armistice, had been considered absolutely absurd. They couldn't possibly have played football in such circumstances and in such terrain. And yet I found in the Imperial War Museum and in German documents war diaries, that is official documents, the daily reports, that not only talked about the football games, but gave the scores.
The scores corroborated each other in many senses, didn't
they? Yes, they did. Yeah. And the result was that more and more of what had been called a myth turned out to be reality.
You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, and today we're recalling a rare moment in the history of warfare when troops from opposing sides, drawn by their curiosity of each other and a lack of will to fight on through Christmas, began to fraternize with their adversaries. In this case, in Flanders Field during December 1914 in World War I. Historian and author of the book Silent Night, The Story of the Christmas Truce of 1914, Stanley Weintraub, is telling us the tale. And Dr. Weintraub, you unearthed many letters and artifacts proving this rather widespread fraternizing. And I'm wondering if you would, for us, read this one letter that you quoted starting on page 83.
This is a British officer writing. More Germans had emerged between the lines, and he wrote, "Things were getting a bit thick. My men were getting a bit excited. We didn't like to fire, as they were all unarmed, but we had strict orders, and someone might have fired. So I climbed over the parapet and shouted my best German for the opposing captain to appear. We met and formally saluted. He introduced himself as Count something or other, and seemed a very decent fellow. He could not talk a word of English. He then called one of his subalterns and formally introduced them with much clicking of heels and saluting. They were all very well turned out, while I was in a goatskin coat. One of the subalterns could talk a few words of English. I said, 'My orders are to keep my men in the trenches and allow no armistice. Don't you think it is dangerous, all of your men running about in the open like this? Someone may open fire.' He called out an order, and all his men went back to their parapet, leaving me and the five German officers and a barrel of beer in the middle of no man's land. He said, 'You better take the beer. We have lots.' So I called up two men to bring the barrel to our side. I didn't like to take their beer without giving something in exchange, and suddenly I had a brainwave. We had lots of plum puddings, so I sent for one and formally presented it to him in exchange for the beer. He then called out, 'Waiter,' and a German private whipped out six glasses and two bottles of beer, and with much bowing and saluting, we solemnly drank it, and cheers from both sides. Then we all formally saluted and returned to our lines. Our men had sing-songs, ditto the enemy." So this is one example of how fraternization began and the truce continued.
Hello, Tommy.
Tommy was the nickname the Germans had for the English soldiers. Here, another dramatization of the troops meeting up in the film Oh, What a Lovely War.
Alles gut, ja?
Oh, ja, ja. Es trinken wir Schnaps.
About bloody time, too.
That's good stuff, Jay.
Hey, thank you very much.
Bitte schön.
Fritz.
Huh. How are you, Fritz?
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. How's the Kaiser?
How are your trenches?
Terrible. Not fit for pigs. When it rains, we're up to our knees in mud and water.
Aren't you sick of the war? Before the war, I was staying in Suffolk. And I left there a 3 1/2 horsepower motorcycle. And also a girl.
Hey, do you hear that?
This chap's got a girlfriend in Suffolk. We will not ever shoot again. Unless you start.
Do you hear that?
That'll suit us, man, I can tell you.
Here.
We'll drink to that. That is Scottish schnapps.
This is your guns that are shooting.
No. The bastard English. No us.
They will not shoot at us while you are here.
Don't believe that, man. It does their shooting, that.
Oh, well. Thanks very much, mate, and give my love to the comments.
A clip from the film Oh, What a Lovely War, a 1969 adaptation of a 1963 British stage play. So how long did it go on, and how did it come to an end?
It went on in some places just through Christmas. It depended on the area involved and how close the people were and how pressured they felt by commanding officers to the rear. What is interesting, and the point is made very well in film and the play, Oh, What a Lovely War, is that senior officers seldom ventured toward the front lines. So that meant that the troops could do pretty much what they wanted. But when reports came back to the fancy chateaus in the rear where the generals were stationed, they complained about it, and they issued orders that this had to stop. And it stopped as soon as they sent replacements out to take the places of the troops that had fraternized.
And from your standpoint, Dr. Weintraub, why do you think this story resonates so well and so closely with people now, almost 100 years later?
I think it resonates because we yearn for a time when there is greater peace than we have, a time when every day, as the poet said, will be like Christmas Day, a day when families get together, when there's camaraderie, when there's friendliness, when hatred vanishes. It's a utopian idea, a utopian vision, but we all long for it. When we get close enough, we realize that on both ends of the rifle, we're the same. The trouble is that we or at least governments, never learn from history. The lesson of the Christmas truce has vanished, as all truces vanish this way, because peace is harder to make than war.
Dr. Stanley Weintraub taught many, many years at Penn State and is also the author of many fine books, including the 2001-2002 book, Silent Night, The Story of the World War I Christmas Truce. Stanley Weintraub, thanks so much for sharing your stories with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution, with all of our episodes to hear online at peacetalksradio.com. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls. Now to the story of another war and a peacemaking wound-healing event that happened 50 years after its end. In late April of 1865, the American Civil War was not entirely finished, even though Robert E. Lee had surrendered at Appomattox and President Lincoln had been assassinated in Washington. Tens of thousands of Union and Confederate troops in North Carolina stood ready to keep on fighting if the final negotiations between their own commanders failed. Among the war-weary Southern soldiers camped in Greensboro, North Carolina, was a young signal corpsman named David Hamilton Russell. To the east in Raleigh, a Northern Signal Corps lieutenant, George Carr Round, manned an observation post atop the state capitol building. Round, like Russell, had been a soldier since the war began, and he prayed that he would soon hear that the Confederate General Joseph Johnston and Union General William Sherman had come to terms. When that news arrived at last, on the night of April 26th, Round sent what's known as the last signal message of the Civil War, launching color-coded rockets from the Capitol Dome in Raleigh to spell out peace on earth, goodwill to men. Half a century later, in 1911, Round and Russell's life stories converged again. The result of that was the National Jubilee of Peace, the first major gathering of Civil War veterans from both sides. Steve Pendlebury has our story from the place where it happened in 1911 and was reenacted in the summer of 2011. He spoke with the reenactment planners in Manassas, Virginia.
Reenactors don't always like it when I say it, but I've said for years, you know, why do we reenact the war when it's the peace that's so much more interesting, exciting, and ultimately beneficial to our children and for the generations to come?
That's Ken Elston, the chairman of the George Mason University Theater Department. He wrote and directed a dramatization of the Peace Jubilee for the city of Manassas.
It's a far-reaching sort of epic outdoor piece that is, you know, part theater, part spectacle, part halftime show.
Elston's historical theater troupe Footsteps in Time recreated the unprecedented reunion of veterans from North and South who came together in Manassas on July 21, 1911 for a celebration of peace and national unity, 50 years to the day after the first major land battle of the Civil War.
With the possible exception of the Persian Wars, this is the first time in recorded history that former enemies met on the same battlefield where they once met in mortal combat to affirm peace. And that's pretty exciting. When you look at the history of the world, the U.S. is unique for a lot of reasons. One of those reasons is that we had this terrible four-year struggle of the American Civil War and came out of it a stronger nation. You know, I'm from Philadelphia, and in Philadelphia we always celebrate the birth of the nation, 1776. And it seems to me that here in Manassas, Virginia, we celebrate the rebirth of the nation.
I think one of the stories that is, you know, sometimes lost at Manassas, because the battle, being the first battle, grabs the nation's attention, is the story of reconciliation.
It's a story Manassas National Battlefield Park Superintendent Ed Clark doesn't get to tell as often as he'd like.
Both sides taking up, you know, their previous positions and marching across the field, instead of this time not in anger and not with bloodshed on their mind, but with peace and reconciliation in their mind. And instead of meeting with arms, they met with handshakes.
More about how the 1911 Peace Jubilee came to be in a few moments. But first, to appreciate how extraordinary the event was, you have to understand what happened during the First Battle of Manassas, or Bull Run as it's also known, 50 years earlier.
At the beginning of the Civil War, you know, after Lincoln is elected and Fort Sumter occurs and he calls all of the troops, there was, I think, great excitement, both in the North and the South, for what was coming. They ended up meeting here, as they say it at the time, on the plains of Manassas. And what both sides endured that day, on that July 21st day, shocked the nation.
Families brought their children and their picnic lunches from as far away as D.C. to sit and watch the spectacle of overwhelming force from the north taking on the ragged band from the south, or the plantation owners here believing that the show of southern pride and dedication to state and this new idea of the new Confederate States of America would overwhelm the forces of the Union. Certainly no one believed in their heart of hearts, at least these people with their picnic lunches, that Americans would be killing Americans right in front of their eyes.
George Carr Round, the Union officer who proclaimed peace with his signal rockets in Raleigh at the end of the war, was not at the First Battle of Manassas, although he too was profoundly affected by his experiences throughout the conflict. He was stationed in Manassas for a while later in the war to defend the Strategic Railroad Junction. Round became a lawyer in New York and returned to settle in Manassas in 1868. Although some of the locals dismissed him as a carpetbagger at first, Round became a pillar of the community.
He named the streets. So we're at the corner of Grant and Lee. We're at the corner of Grant and Lee so that they would forever meet in peaceful accord. That was very important to him.
The inscription on his tombstone at Arlington National Cemetery hails Round as the originator of the Peace Jubilee. But the idea for the event actually came from D.H. Russell, who was among the last Confederate troops to surrender in Greensboro. Russell was wounded at First Manassas, and after the war he became a newspaper editor and civic leader in Anderson, South Carolina. On January 2, 1911, Russell wrote a letter to the editor of the Washington Post. Bob Root reads from that letter.
The 21st day of next July will be the 50th anniversary of the First Battle of Manassas, and it has occurred to me that it would be a gracious thing, and tending to promote peace and good feeling, if Congress would make an appropriation to bring together in a national encampment on that celebrated field the survivors of both armies who actually participated in the battle. It would be a spectacle that could not take place in any other country on the globe and would have a good effect in promoting the rising tide of peace and goodwill that seems to be prevailing over the country and in wiping out any remaining animosities. What do you think of it?
George Round thought it was a great idea, and it was the old veteran, not Congress, who turned it into a reality just half a year after reading Russell's letter in the newspaper. A remarkable feat, says Ed Clark.
He pulled all of these people together, and if you think about trying to get, you know, in rural Virginia at that time, this many people to transport that far, to get that message out that far, to coordinate all of that, it must have taken a tremendous amount of effort and energy.
Hundreds of veterans gathered on the hilltop where the tide of the battle had turned, where Confederate General Stonewall Jackson earned his nickname, and where the blood-curdling rebel yell was heard for the first time. This time, the former foes embraced. They shared a picnic lunch. Then they headed to the courthouse in town to see the President of the United States, William Howard Taft.
America, we look to thee with thanks to those who made us free. North, south, east, west, all hand in hand, united.
it's difficult to celebrate. You can commemorate. You can keep memories alive. You can talk about the stories that weave together. But you can't really celebrate such a bloody war. You can celebrate the Peace Jubilee. You can celebrate people coming together and those veterans meeting again in their dotage to hold hands, to put their arms around each other, to stand around a campfire, which they did here on the lawn. We're sitting in the courthouse in Manassas City now, where the event happened in 1911. And the lawn was dotted with campfires for an entire week, as the veterans didn't leave this property. And they told stories, and they laughed, and they sang, and they really had a jubilee.
Colonel Berkeley, you live in Virginia all your life?
Heck no! Not yet, anyway.
We have been remembering those bygone days today, and Manassas has offered us so many fond memories to carry on with us forever.
Fond memories. The last time I was down here, my tent leaked something awful.
Well, didn't you fix it?
Couldn't fix it in the rain.
Well, why didn't you fix it when the sun was shining?
It didn't leak then.
You know, we have this dance among the people. We have these scenarios among this crowd. We have the President of the United States coming down Grant Avenue in his car, being led by children of the community.
I think it's so iconic to have President Taft, the United States President, on the stage with the last Virginia governor who had served in the Confederacy on that stage together.
As promised, folks, the President of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, when we look back on that period of 50 years ago, a feeling of sadness must overcome us. But that is a period we dislike to look back upon. A period of sorrow and discouragement, reviving in our minds all the strain and trial of that awful struggle. I do not know if it might have been achieved in some more peaceful way. I do not know if we could have found an alternate path. But I do know that in that struggle, each side showed a strength which neither side had known that it possessed, developed a strength of character before the entire world, that the world had never witnessed before. It is my greatest ambition as President of these United States to do everything sensible and everything reasonably possible to bring the two sections of this country even closer together, if such be possible, to make them feel in the South as well as in the North that the Supreme Court of the United States is their Supreme Court, the Congress their Congress, the President of the United States their President.
I think it's so important at these times, at these, you know, milestones, these markers in history, to recall these events and remind America of places we have been and great things we have done.
I would love to be able to say that there was actual lasting attention to this idea of peace and love and unity, and that we as a community put that on our shoulders as what we would model for the rest of the world. And I'm afraid that we as a society and as a people and as a race and a species maybe haven't yet come to that particular place in our lives yet.
For Peace Talks Radio, I'm Steve Pendlebury.
You can find links to more information about the Peace Jubilee celebration of both 1911 and its commemoration in 2011 at our website, peacetalksradio.com, where you can also find more about the World War I Christmas Truce of 1914, which we talked about earlier with author Stanley Weintraub, all at peacetalksradio.com. That's also where you can hear an hour-long version of this program with much more from our guests. And peacetalksradio.com is where you can hear all the programs in our series going back to 2003, order CDs of most episodes, sign up for a podcast and our newsletter. And it's also where you can make a tax-deductible contribution to our nonprofit media organization that produces this program independently from your local public radio station. Please consider a donation. It really will help. For more frequent updates and inspiration, follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Additional support comes from the Oppenheimer Brothers Foundation, the F&S Fund of the Santa Fe Community Foundation, and KUNM at the University of New Mexico. Special thanks to Steve Pendlebury, too, for years of support of all kinds, and for today's report on the Manassas Peace Jubilee. Allie Adelman composed and performs our theme music. I'm Paul Engels. Thank you for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
90.1 FM, KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Streaming online at www.kkfi.org.